In this talk, I will. As Alessia said, I'm a postdoc at Tokyo Institute of Technology. And during my PhD and also recently, I've been working on aspects of non-local theories. So I will be telling you a bit what it is about and what I'm interested in and what I've been doing. Before going to the main part of the talk, let's start with some well-known facts, with some motivation. We know that Einstein general relativity has been tested very well in the infrared regime. And it is described by a very simple action, which just contains one linear invariant, which is the Ricci scalar. But at the same time, we also know that despite its great achievements, as soon as we approach, for instance, short distances, we encounter short distances or short time scales, we encounter curvature singularities from a classical point of view. But even at quantum level, we have some kind of singularity, which are basically UV divergences, which appear at high energies, and that make the theory non-perturbatively normalizable. So we know that basically, outside the infrared regime, so when we approach ultraviolet scales, GR breaks down, and we need to do something about that. We can even ask, so it's very natural to ask the following question: to what extent is GR valid in the ultraviolet regime? And actually, if just we think experimentally, if you want to test, for instance, the Newton's law potential in a laboratory, and you want to see up to which distance scale we have been testing just the 1/r² force, what we can say is that basically what we know is that up to 10 micrometers, this force has been tested. But for instance, if we take two masses at a distance of one nanometer, we cannot really say if in a laboratory, we can say that really Newtonian gravity still holds or not, just because experimentally we haven't explored the regime. So let's say there is a huge scale, if you think of from these 10 micrometers to the Planck length, there is a huge scale of, there is a huge desert of order of magnitudes in which we really don't know anything about short distance gravity. And I would say that in my opinion, the most conservative way to really go beyond GR is to try to extend the Einstein Hilbert action. And actually, this is a very natural way to extend it, to add high order curvature in the Lagrangian. For instance, if we consider this Lagrangian, where we have basically the standard GR Einstein-Hilbert term plus Ricci square, Ricci scalar square plus Ricci tensor squared in four dimension, this Lagrangian was shown to be renormalizable by Kellogg's tail in 1977, which is actually a very nice result. But at the same time, even though the theory is normalizable, it happens that if we study, for instance, perturbation around Minkowski background, and we compute perturbation in this way, where this will be the fluctuation to quantize, and we compute the propagator for this type of fluctuation, what we get is a propagator of this type, where here I'm not writing the four indices just for simplicity, where we have the standard massless graviton that we also have in Einstein-Hilbert case. But then we also have extra degrees of freedom, where we have a massive spin zero mode plus, minus massive spin two mode. And because of this minus sign, what happens basically, this massive spin two component is a Gauss degree of freedom, which basically, if we read off this term in the kinetic term, it will have a negative energy in front of it. And so because of this minus sign, we have several problems. For instance, classically, we can have Hamiltonian instabilities just because we are considering a theory which is higher order in derivatives. But quantum mechanics, we also have problems because the theory basically is not unitary. So unitarity and the optical theorem is broken because of this minus sign. So we have this conflict between unitarity and renormalizability when we try to study perturbative quantum gravity. So what we'd like to discuss in this talk is how can we tackle this issue that we encounter in a high derivative gravity, and whether we can really try to solve this problem of unitarity. There is a question, I can see.
Yes, so there is a question on the chat by
Charlie. So the question is, if we take beta equal to zero, is it still renormalizable? And if so, does the Gauss still exist? So the question are two. So if we take beta equal to zero, there is no Gauss which appear, because basically you will only have these two parts. Okay, but the theory is not renormalizable, just because if you compute some loop integral, you would generate terms like this. Okay, so you need to add them. And there is also another question.
Yes, if you take beta equals to zero, you can't find the propagator. I don't think
so.
If you take beta equals to zero, mm-hmm. If you take beta equals to zero, you're not defining the theory perturbatively because you can't invert to find the propagator. So you
If we take beta equal to zero as a starting Lagrangian, so you will only have this one.
Yes.
So basically you have, let's say, this is the sometime called like Starobinsky also Starobinsky Lagrangian. Theory which is not a GI, we have an extra spin zero mode, which is healthy, it's not a Gauss, but the theory is not renormalizable because basically you would generate anyway this type of terms.
Yes. So I think we agree.
Okay, thanks. So I hope also for Charlie it is clear. Well, I don't need to raise it. Okay, perfect. So basically, of course, I didn't say that. In principle, you can ask also why I'm not writing, for instance, Riemann square, something like this. Just because in four dimension, we can use the Gauss-Bonnet identity to remove the Riemann square term and write it in terms of R square and Ricci square. Okay. So as I was saying, what we would like to do in this talk is to see whether we can still work with higher derivative theories and get some theory which is still unitary. And we will see that no locality basically will be important for doing this. What we're going to do in this talk, let's just briefly mention. We're going to first try to understand why the Gauss breaks unitarity. We start from the simple high derivative scalar field theories and see why these minus signs create some problems. So it will be clear everyone why there is a problem because of these Gauss modes. Then we will see how to solve this problem just for a scalar field theory. And then we'll try to do the same for the gravity case. Okay. Well, in the last part of the talk, I'd like to discuss more about unitarity at higher loop, because in the last year, there have been lots of progress in proving unitarity for the type of local models that we show. And so what we're going to do, we just take some field theory model and discuss unitarity. And we will also see how this discussion of unitarity can be generalized also to more complicated Lagrangian, like the gravity one and any other one that we are interested in. Okay. So it's also nice to mention that in the last years, in the last decades, there have been lots of attempts to tackle this problem unitary derivatizability in higher derivative theories. Actually, in your group, there are many experts in asymptotically safe gravity, but there have been also other approaches which I'm not going to say much about that. I will not say anything about that. But what we're going to do is to focus on non-local gravity theories, non-local theories. And I should also mention that John Moffat, which I can see in the audience, he has worked a lot on non-local approaches to both field theory and gravity. So let's start just to understand why the Gauss is a problem for unitarity. Well, for instance, what we can do just to understand the problem is to take a simple scalar field model with four derivatives, which can mimic the scalar, let's say, the structure of the spin two graviton propagator in four order gravity. Okay. So for instance, what we have is a structure like this where we have a massless pole plus a massive pole here. And if we write down the propagator will have some structure like this. So basically, we invert the Kleene term with the composite and we get two modes. And when we want to prove unitary, what we usually, one way to prove unitary in quantum field theory is to prove the optical theorem, which is written in terms of the transfer matrix and not in terms of the S matrix. And we can see immediately why this minus sign can create problems. For instance, if we take an interaction term like this, lambda FAQ. So we'll have this three-level diagram with two constant vertices, and the amplitude will be just proportional to the propagator. But if we compute the imaginary part of the propagator, it so happens that the propagator is can be also negative, which is basically against one of the necessary conditions of the optical theorem. And that's why ghosts are problematic and can break unitarity. So what we would like to ask is whether given a Lagrangian like this with some f of box operator here, whether we can have a theory which is still half derivative but Gauss free. And as we will see in a moment, the locality can help us in doing this. Before going on, let's just fix the terminology, what we mean with the locality and no locality. So when we speak about local Lagrangian, what we mean is just a Lagrangian, which is polynomial in the derivatives acting on a field. So for instance, in a Lagrangian, we can have something like this, where the order of derivative is finite. So we have just polynomial of derivatives, let's say. But when we speak about non-local Lagrangian, what we mean is that the Lagrangian is non-polynomial in the derivative. So for instance, besides having polynomial derivative like this, we can also have non-polynomial differential operator. For instance, exponential box, logarithmic box, one-way box, and so on. What we're gonna focus on, especially in this talk, are analytic operator of box. Okay, for instance, this type of operator naturally appear in the context of string field theory and the periodic string. I'm not an expert of string field theory periodic string, but they appear. For instance, string field theory, they appear in the cubic vertex of the so-called Witten vertex. And one can see also in periodic string, they just appear in the structure of the propagator. So what we're gonna do here now is just to construct by hand some Lagrangian, which is non-local, and see what we can do with that. Of course, we are not deriving them from first principles. We will discuss something about first principle at the end of the talk. But what we're gonna do now is just to basically start with some Lagrangian and just present some proof of principle of Lagrangian that can work for what we want to do, basically. So let's start just in a constructive way. Let's take a general scalar Lagrangian, where we have a generic f of box operator to start with. Now, what we're going to require to make some progress is that this operator is an entire function. So it does not have any pole in the complex plane. It can have zeros, but no poles. So for sure, this is a necessary condition to have good IR limit, which allow us to recover, for instance, the Klein-Gordon operator in some low energy regime, if we consider a UV extension of this Lagrangian. But immediately, since the function is an entire function, this f of box, we can immediately use the Weierstrass theorem, which factorize basically this f of box in this way. There will be a piece which takes into account all the zeros of this operator, a product of all the zeros, times some exponential of a function which I'm calling gamma, where this gamma is another entire function. And here, this n is the number of zeros that this f of box has. Mi square are zeros of this operator. And Ri is the multiplicity of each zero. So this is just a theorem. So just comes from the fact that we are assuming entire function. And now, given this expression for f(x), we can make some classification. For instance, if we take here we can also invert the f(x) and write the propagator in this way, in a very generic form, okay, where we haven't made explicit the type of theory we want to consider. We can just invert the kinetic operator, okay? So let's just start doing some classification. For instance, I mean, very simple. If we take n equal to 1, r equal to 1, gamma equal to 0, we just have the standard Frank Gordon Lagrangian. If we take n equal to 2, r equal to 1 and gamma equal to 0, we have a four-order derivative Lagrangian, which has ghosts, as we showed before. That's because we have an extra real pole, which creates problems. But we can see what happens, for instance, when we set gamma different from zero, this exponential of this entire function. And actually, for instance, if we take n equal to 1, r equal to 1, and gamma different from zero, we can have a Lagrangian, which contains infinite order derivatives because of this exponential, because of this non-polynomial differential operator. And actually, as we can see, the Lagrangian or the propagator does not have any new pole. So we still have the standard pole, which comes from the two derivative theory. And then we have this extra piece here, which is an higher derivative piece, but it does not introduce any new pole, just because by definition, this function is an exponential of an entire function, which does not vanish. It can have essential singularity at infinity, as we will discuss later, but does not introduce any new pole. So this is an example indeed of theory, which is still a higher derivative, but does not violate, let's say, does not introduce any new ghost, any new extra degree of freedom. And in terms of unitarity and causality, this theory have been studied. So I'm just mentioning some recent papers about this. What I'm going to discuss more deeply later is like unitarity for this type of theory. So let's just wait for a moment for that. We're going to discuss perturbative unitarity. But what we're going to do now is to show that basically the same type of constructions with these non-local operators can be also done for a gravity Lagrangian. So basically, we can have a higher derivative gravity Lagrangian that can show these features. It can be higher derivative, but free of but without any new extra degree of freedom. But this can happen only if we introduce no locality in the Lagrangian. So let's do how it works. Before going to the gravity case, if there is any question, maybe this is also. John Moffat, there is a question. You are muted, John.
Sorry. If your chair is the simplest entire function, just it's a Gaussian entire function. If you choose the simplest entire function, mm-hmm. it's a Gaussian distribution.
Yes.
Which is entire. And if you choose it to be positive, it's one of the conditions that I would demand, then you maintain analyticity and metricity, and you can prove unitarity perturbative, as you pointed out. As we know, we disagree about causality.
We had some discussion already about causality.
I still maintain that I'm correct. But I appreciate your input on this. It's been a controversial issue. Just a quick comment. What you have to prove for microcausality is that two operators, field operators, non-local, determined in terms of an entire function, in terms of a local operator, field operator. But it vanishes for space-like separation.
Yes, yes.
And I can prove this just using the Lorentz invariance. And Another way of doing it is use the book Bogoyubov Shakov, causality, microcausality condition. It's published in his book Bogoyubov Shakov. And it was proved by Efimov, the pioneers of more local theory, in a published paper, that you can prove microcausality with this Bogoyubov Shakov result. People are not really aware of this publication, but it's the case. So he agrees, Efimov agrees with me on this issue. I think this is a very important point, because the issue of locality is important as far as locality is concerned. And it's just clear that outside the light cone, two measurements cannot affect one another. It's just very simple. It follows from Lorentz invariance.
Yeah, but
sorry for this long discussion. Please continue.
So I don't know besides the details of Efimov's proof. I think it's something from the 60s. But what I was mentioning here, at least, I actually have some extra slides now. I can show them. We can maybe discuss a bit now and then if there is more time later. But at least in terms of like commutator, or like even if we take, for instance, the propagator, we see that there is some extra non-Gaussian contribution, the propagator, which is not a time order structure. There is something different, which basically is breaking the causality of the Feynman propagator. And in this statement I'm making, I'm not the only one, because there is a kind of agreement also among other authors. And what I'm just saying, to be more specifically, this slide. This is just an extra slide. But for instance, what I mean is that if we compute the propagator for this type of Lagrangian, for this type of theory, for instance, now this is just in a formal way, the propagator can be written like a time-ordered part plus an extra contribution, which breaks this time-ordered structure. So we don't have any more the usual form where we have like a positive energy propagating forward in time and negative energy propagating backward in time, because of this extra contribution here, which, by the way, cannot be zero, because if it was zero, then we would have just the local propagator. Okay, so we had already still some discussion about this point here. Okay, and for instance, you were saying that we can make a Lorentz transformation to make these two equal for space-like separation. This is true, but we need to be careful, because if there was no derivative here, that can be done trivially. But here there is a derivative acting on this function. So it means that the difference is Lorentz invariant in the end, but not each single piece. So we cannot apply like the transformation for space-like separation for each piece, and then they say that they cancel because they're equal. So in this sense, I would say that the theory is still Lorentz invariant. That's totally fine. But we are, anyway, because of this non-local operator, we are going outside the light cone a bit. And this can be seen at least in the structure of the propagator from this extra non-time-ordered operator. Now, okay, for sure you have something to say, but I think we can, for sure, I would like to discuss more about this, even after the talk.
It's better probably to take some questions and then continue the discussion after the talk.
Yeah. By the way, this is one of the issues with Zoom talks. We can't sit in an office with a blackboard.
Yeah, I know, that would be nice. But I have something to write here, so in principle, we can write something.
So maybe we
can... For now, Luca, perhaps continue.
Indeed. Let's go back to the main.
Please continue.
But thank you, John. So let's start with the gravity part. So I guess if we follow the schedule strictly, I have 15 minutes. No, sorry, 20 minutes.
But, no, I mean it's fine. You already had a couple of questions.
Okay, good. So let's see what we can do for the gravity case. Of course, what I showed so far in terms of gravity Lagrangian is some high-derivative Lagrangian where there was just some curvature square multiplied by some constant coefficient. But if we think in terms of different Friesen invariants, we can have, of course, more general structure. For instance, in principle, no one can prohibit us to write something like this, okay, which is still something which is covariant, different Friesen invariant. And we are introducing three different form factors, which in the Stelle theory, for order theory, they will be just constants. More generally, can be any function. And what we are going to require also here is that this entire function, these functions of box are entire function. So analytic function of box, we can expand them in series, formally, something like this. And since we want to just see what happens to the graviton propagator in this Lagrangian, we can just, around Minkowski, we can just confine ourselves to basically quadratic Lagrangian in the fluctuations. And in this sense, we can use this very nice identity, which basically allow us to rewrite the Riemann part in terms of the Ricci, tensor Ricci scalar, and then cubic order in the curvature. But since around Minkowski, order R cube is proportional to H cube when we take the perturbation, G mu nu equal to eta plus H mu nu. We can, I mean, for the propagator, this contribution will be irrelevant. Okay, so what we are going to consider basically to see what happens to, in a very general way, to the graviton propagator is a Lagrangian like this, where we have just the R squared part and the Ricci squared part. And if we do perturbation on Minkowski, we can write the propagator in this very generic form, where we have a spin two component and a spin zero component. Now, the spin two and spin zero are spin project operators. I'm not writing the expression, I mean, it's not needed. If there are questions, we can go into details. But what is important is the pole structure, because if we take F equal to one and G equal to one, we recover the standard graviton propagator, where off shell we have both spin two and spin zero, and then off shell we only have the two spin two listis. But more generically, we have this structure where this function F and G are just combination of these form factors. So now we can ask, of course, can we choose some form factor F1, F2, such that the propagator is Gauss-free, in the sense of like, does not introduce any new extra degrees of freedom besides the one that we have, that we know are healthy? And the answer is yes, actually it's very easy, because we can just, for instance, choose this type of structure, where basically we are again introducing exponential of entire functions. And of course, we can also allow one extra spin zero mode, which is healthy, because we know that we can have massless graviton spin two plus some healthy spin zero mode. So, which means that if we start from Lagrangian, where our F of box, initial F of box, the form factors are written in terms of these non-local operators, we can end up with a theory which is perturbatively Gauss-free around Minkowski. Of course, here I'm just speaking about not three-level case, when I see what happens at higher loop and so on. We'll discuss something later soon. But let's just see some simple example. What happens, for instance, for some simple Lagrangian we can write down? For instance, we can, the simplest Lagrangian we can write down is the one where there is only one form factor. So we can choose some relation between the two form factors like this. And the Lagrangian will get this expression where we have the Einstein tensor and the Ricci tensor. And if we write down the propagator for this type of Lagrangian, we get something like this, where again, this F of box is an exponential of an entire function. And as also John was saying, what the simplest choice one can make is an exponential of box. So basically we take gamma function here as a polynomial of degree one. So by just we take a monot, so we just take a box operator. Now, of course, there is a big freedom. We'll discuss also about this big freedom later. And let me just say, for instance, if we have this type of Lagrangian, what kind of physical implication? Yes, Charlie.
Sorry, I'm a little confused. So why is it, how do I see that it's Gauss-free? Because there's still that minus sign there.
Ah, yeah, I didn't say this. So basically, this is the graviton. Very good question. I just leave it for. So we have this expression here. Okay. Now this is, I know that we usually don't write in this way, but this is just the gauge fixes, I mean, the gauge fixing independent part of the graviton propagator in GR. Because when you go off shell, before going on shell, you will see both spin two and spin zero component also in GR, just for the graviton propagator. Indeed, you will have basically off shell 5 plus 1 degree of freedom. But what happens is that when you go on shell, okay, what will survive in the end is only the plus minus two helicities from the spin two part. And indeed, the spin zero part is very important. It is a good ghost, it's not a bad ghost. It is a good ghost because it is the one that cancels the longitudinal mode that is here, the zero mode of the spin two. So this minus sign is just the one that you also have in GR, because in GR you have a spin zero ghost when you're off shell. But this does not propagate. Okay. So.
Right. Yeah. I think I've heard that before. So, just a quick question though. You were adding a mass term earlier. Is that adding like the zero mode within those five degrees of freedom, which is a healthy spin zero
yes,
degree
healthy,
of freedom?
This is a healthy. Okay. Yes.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Okay. So let's just see quickly before going to discuss some aspects of unitarity. Let's see quickly some implication of this, for instance, exponential. So let's ask a simple question.
I think a question by John.
Yeah, is this theory locally gauge invariant? GR is locally gauge invariant.
Yes, the gauge invariant, the transformation is always the same.
So the extra contribution with the minus sign comes from gauge fixing.
This one?
Yeah.
No, this is, so let me just try it better. So basically, if we just take the graviton propagator, in the graviton propagator, there will be, in GR, the spin two, let me write it better. There will be, so graviton propagator, 40 minutes, there will be a spin two part, minus a spin zero part, like this, plus there will be the terms depending on the gauge fixing, where there is, this is one of the spin zero, let's call it spin zero S. Then there will be also other terms here, which include the spin one and also the other spin zero, because we can decompose basically H mu in the SO3 representation, like two plus one, plus zero. Okay, the 10 degrees of freedom around SO3. So what happens is that when we compute the propagator, the gauge fixing dependent part is this one. So I'm not writing that basically, but the spin zero here does not depend on the gauge fixing.
Okay, so that's a real cost.
Huh?
It has a minus sign, so that's a cost.
It's a minus sign, yes. It's a minus sign.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Indeed, this minus sign, as I was saying, is very important to, because the spin two part will have plus two plus one zero minus one minus two components, and this zero component here is cancelled by this when we take some amplitude, for instance, when we contract with some energy tensor on the left and right hand side. So it's very important. So yeah. Let's go on. Yeah, okay, I will go a bit quicker now here. So for instance, if we just take an exponential log box and we want to study what happens to, we just place a point-like source, static point-like source in space-time around Minkowski, and we want to study the weak field limit around this background. What happens is that we need to solve some kind of non-polynomial differential equation, a modified Poisson equation of this type. And if we solve it, we get a modified Newtonian potential, of course, where there is the standard Newtonian potential times this error function for this type of model. And very nicely, this error function also gives a smoother behavior when we go to r equal to zero. Of course, this is just a linear solution, but it's just nice to see that we are just trying to tackle the unitarity problem, but we also get some I would say, nice implication in other directions. Well, I can skip like the discussion about the curvature. Basically, what no locality is supposed to do is to smear out like curvature singularities. Now, this is just a linear analysis. We can discuss later non-linear case, but it's still very open the topic. One can also discuss some rotating case, but let's skip it. There is no time for this. Now, what I said so far was just basically some local model, okay, where we are keeping the same degree of freedom of the standard theory. So we are keeping the same poles of the standard theory. For instance, we can have at most massless graviton plus the healthy spin zero mode. But one can ask, is this really the most general kind of Gauss-free operators that we can have? Actually, the answer is no. So the fact that this answer is no is not good because it means that the class is even larger. So we have too many models and we need to really constrain all these models. We need to prove out some of these models. But I think it's good to mention that there are more possibilities. Because so far what I show is just basically something like this, where we have only one degree of freedom and some non-local operator. Now we can ask, for instance, if we increase, if we keep no locality, we increase the number of poles here, what happens? The number of zeros, what happens? Actually, okay, we know already that if we introduce extra real zeros, we will introduce some cost, that's for sure. But actually, if we take, for instance, three zeros, among which one is real and two are complex conjugates, we can still have a Gauss-free propagator. Why? Because basically, in this case, we will have what I wrote before here, times some operator like this, which can be written like a product of a complex conjugate zeros like this. And if we compute the propagator, what we get is the standard that one that I was showing before, plus a simple real extra piece. Indeed, for instance, if we want to evaluate imaginary part just at tree level, we could see immediately that basically this propagator will not contribute to the imaginary part of the amplitude, just because we have the complex conjugate poles which cancel each other. So it means that basically we can allow for like the complex conjugate poles besides the healthy real one, and still have some kind of Gauss-free theory, which is still higher derivative. It can be done both in local and local case. For instance, we can have this type of like this type of Lagrangian like this, which shows still some kind, which not introduce Gauss. You don't see extra real poles which can propagate. And it can be done even more crazy things. One can introduce even infinite sets of pairs of complex conjugate poles in the theory and still try to keep things under control. And the same can be done also for gravity, of course. One can always write a Lagrangian that exhibits some graviton propagator, which just has the standard graviton poles plus extra complex conjugate poles, which, however, do not propagate as Gauss. Now, if there are more questions later, but we don't need to really go into details here. In this last 10, 15 minutes, maybe 10-15 minutes, I would like just to discuss some aspects of perturbative unitarity. Because I spoke about non-local operators, which are unitary and so on, but it's not really clear, I would say, why they are unitary, because we have this exponential, right? We need to ask also what happens to higher loops. And in this sense, one should really try to show perturbative unitarity if you want to study perturbative quantum field theory for these models. And when I speak about perturbative unitarity, what I mean is just to prove basically, the optical theorem perturbatively at each loop order. And for instance, what I was writing before was some expression like this at the beginning. If we introduce in states and out states, we can write the relation for the matrix elements of this transfer matrix. And what we get is a relation like this, the U-standard optical theorem relation with which we can work and make computation. Now, in what follows, I will just call the left-hand side, which is this left-hand side, and the right-hand side, I will call it just right-hand side. but let's keep in mind that I'm just saying that the left-hand side of the unitary relation of the optical theorem and the right-hand side of the optical theorem. And what I'm going to discuss, some one loop computation, three level and one loop computation, and see how to deal with that. And what kind of problem we need to overcome to compute amplitudes and discuss unitarity and show unitarity. So for instance, at one loop, diagrammatically, it means that we need to show this type of relations. Okay. So for instance, three level, we should show something like this. I mean, we don't need this, but it's just diagrammatically to tell you what we're going to prove. Just to warm up, for instance, why this exponential of box operator do not violate unitarity at three level for a Lagrangian lattice, for instance, where there is some type of interaction. Interaction term, of course, does not change the story as long as they do not introduce new poles. But usually, we assume interaction term that do not introduce poles in the amplitudes. And for instance, if you want to compute the left-hand side of the optical theorem for this three-level process, we should compute this difference, this matrix element, this matrix element, which is one of the complex conjugate. And basically, this is simple equal to this. And here, what we're going to use is basically one usually use the standard relation like 1 over x plus minus I epsilon equal to the principal value of 1 over x minus plus pi delta of x. And by doing this, one can compute like the imaginary part of this left-hand side. Sorry, the left-hand side of the optical theorem. And actually, if one does the same for the right-hand side, where asked to evaluate just the sum over the intermediate state, one gets exactly the same. So at three levels, it's easy to show that unitarity is not violated. But the question is, okay, we can do the same also for complex conjugate, as I also said, but let's go to the one loop case. A two loop is not trivial at all. Okay. And indeed, for standard poles, only recently has been shown something. And for complex conjugate poles, we are working on that. And the same can be done, actually. Unitarity can be shown at higher loop order. But what is the problem? Okay, let's just mention the problem. Why is not so trivial to show unitarity for these models? When we consider an amplitude, for instance, in standard local two derivative case, what we do, we have an integral, for instance, over k0 and k3, and we need to evaluate this integral. What we usually do, okay, since this propagator falls off at infinity, we can use the residue theorem and write basically the contour over k0 in this way. And it's very important that the contribution from the semi circle here goes to zero when we evaluate the integral. This is very important. But the same, okay, this is the result if we do that. Okay, I'm just writing the result in the local two derivative case, which is the standard cutting rule that we usually write. But why in a local case it's a problem? Why we cannot simply compute amplitudes in a local case? And this is the same problem also in string field theory, where there are these exponential in the vertices. Because we have exponential of entire function, and because of the Liouville theorem, it so happened that this exponential of entire function have to diverge along some direction in the complex plane. This is just a consequence of a theorem, just because they are exponential of entire function. So in some direction in the complex plane, they have to diverge. So it means that if we want to close the contour like this, we cannot do that. Because if we try to close the contour like this, this contribution here will not go to zero. And so we cannot apply the residue theorem. We cannot compute the amplitudes. The same, for instance, if we were thinking to use the Euclidean prescription, start from Euclidean, and then weak rotate, Again, we cannot do that just because at infinity we have divergences. We would hit these divergences, which would spoil the computation and introduce divergent contribution in the amplitudes. For instance, if we just take the simplest exponential, which is exponential of box, exponential minus k squared, this exponential diverges here in this region of the k0 complex plane. But it's very important, it is not divergent along the Euclidean axis, as we will see. Now, there is a way to deal with this contour, deformational contour in Euclidean space. And basically, the thing goes like this. Well, it needs a 5 minutes explanation, I would say. So I should be able to do that. So I hope that the problem is clear. So because of this exponential, we have divergences at infinity. And so we cannot compute amplitude. This is a serious problem. If we cannot compute amplitude, we cannot do anything. So we need to define. So when we quantize a theory, we need to also make sure that we know which kind of prescription we're using to deform contours. So we need to give a prescription to deform contours in the complex plane when we compute amplitudes. And this prescription must be consistent with the optical theorem relation, for instance, in order to satisfy unitarity. So it's not trivial to just find a prescription which really works, that satisfy unitarity and also recover local limit. And the contour prescription goes as follows. Okay, I will show more pictures, it's better, but basically one has to make sure that this exponential converge at least along the Euclidean axis. And once this is true, if this holds, then one has to define the amplitudes in Euclidean space, okay? Make the computation in Euclidean space in some way, which we will discuss. And only after that, one has to analytically continue the complex external energies to real values, okay?
Now you can say, okay, Luca,
yes.
I think there is the question by John.
Just
short.
A quick question. Efimov published some papers some years ago. I also worked on this. He claimed you have to regularize this prescription to get unitarity. You regularize, take the limit of taking the regularization off, and you get a well-defined result, as you would in Euclidean space. I don't know whether you know about these papers.
So I heard. So because I know that there have been works on unitarity, I've heard that the proof that Efimov tried to give of this unitarity was in coordinate space. He was working with the coordinate space amplitude and not with momentum space amplitude. And from what I heard, there was some problem definition of some operators in coordinate space. So there was some criticism on this type of basically proof of unitarity. And that's why, at least from the string free theory side, they have to introduce new techniques to deal with these exponentials and so on. Now, the details of the proof that he tried to give in the 60s, 50s, I don't know the details. I just basically I'm focusing on the recent results of the last 3-4 years of these momentum space proofs, which are quite generic.
Now, we always calculate our loops in Euclidean space.
Yes.
The standard QFT.
Sure, sure.
Use a Euclidean momentum space to do it.
Yes.
And then you analytically continue to cosmic space afterwards.
Sure. So in principle, you can you can do that blindly, say, okay, let's just start from Euclidean and then I do the usual thing that we Minkowski. But we really need to make sure that this works when we need to make sure what kind of, how do we avoid the pinching singularities in a complex plane. And actually, we'll discuss just like this in the next slide. Okay. So, in agreement with John, we should define the amplitude in Euclidean space. Okay. But this is not enough because, as I was saying, if we start from Euclidean and we want to weak rotate, in log of field theory, that would work. But here, look, if we weak rotate, we enter in this region for this type of example, for instance, and the contribution on the Euclidean amplitude here will just give divergent contribution just because we are going up to infinity here, and we are hitting all these essential, all these infinities. So what we should do is to try to avoid, I mean, we need to introduce some new restriction to not weak rotate, because weak rotate doesn't work, to analytic continuum from Euclidean to Minkowski. And the thing is, like, is this, basically. In words, we should start from the Euclidean case, from the Euclidean axis. We should complexify internal and external energies. And to avoid poles and pinchings, which are important first, we need to deform some in some way the contour. But this contour deformation cannot go up to infinity just because we encounter infinities in these non-local theories. The deformation must happen in a finite region of the convex plane. So the question is how to do that. So in the real case has been shown, and also in the convex conjugate case, we have shown that the procedure can be generalized and can be quite generic. Now, basically, it goes like this. In standard, I mean, when we need to worry with amplitudes, we need to worry basically when there is some pinching singularity. That is the basically the, like in local theory, right? When we have a pinching singularity, is the place where we are generating basically all the physics of decay rates and elastic static and so on. So we need to care about this pinching, because the pinching is the point in convex plane where imaginary part can appear in the optical theorem on the left-hand side of the optical theorem. So what this prescription says is the following. You start from Euclidean axis with the complex internal energies and complex external energies. And the initial position of the poles will be this one. Okay. Where again, let's remind ourselves which were this Q1, Q3, Q4. That's the four poles of the propagator, okay? The standard pole that we also have in local theory. So, I mean, we know them. Let's just keep them in mind. And what we have to do is to modify the contour here only in a finite region of the convex plane. So what can happen? When the pinching can happen? The pinching can happen between Q2 and Q3. Why? Because when we analyze the continuum P0 from convex to real values, this pole will move in the convex plane, okay? Will move around. And so it can cross the contour. So we need to deform the contour in such a way that we avoid the crossing, because we need to keep the left poles on the left and the right poles on the right. That's how it works. But the pinching can happen when basically this condition is verified, which means when K2 and K3 hit each other, okay, and hit the contour from two opposite sides. In that case, the contour cannot be modified anymore, just because on the left and the right, you have poles, and there we can generate the pinching. So we need to understand how to deal with this pinching. To do that, let's just try to study three different regions. Region one is when basically Q2 is on the right, on the left of Q3. So even if Q2 cross here, we can modify the contour in this way. And this is allowed, of course, we just topological define a contour in convex plane, which can be done. Okay. And there is basically no problem, because we can do the same from for this and for the complex conjugate amplitude, and the contour doesn't change. That's why we get a zero imaginary part on the left-hand side. So in this regime, we get zero left-hand side. So we do not generate any imaginary part in the optical theorem. If we study opposite regime, when Q2 is larger than Q3, which means this, we are still far from the pinching, but we need to keep in mind that Q2 must be kept on the left of the contour. We cannot exceed, cannot go the other side, otherwise we would generate some pole extra contour, okay, as we will see soon. So if this happens and we are still far from the pinching, because we are taking strict the regime in which P0 is greater than this combination, what we should do is to modify the contour in this way. Also, this is possible. It's a funny contour, but this can be done. There is no problem with that. And we can also topologically modify the contour in this way. Nothing prohibits us to do that. In the end, basically, in this regime, we can write always the contour in this way. And also in this way, if we compute on the left-hand side, the complex conjugate amplitude, because we have amplitude minus complex conjugate, the complex conjugate, we still have the same type of contour. And the two cancel. Okay, if there are questions for details, we can discuss later. The two cancel, and basically we do not generate any imaginary part again. So the imaginary part can only be generated around the pinching when Q2 and Q3 hit each other. So the contour gets hit from two different sides. And so in that case, we cannot modify anything. We just get a pinching singularity in the integration. And what the prescription says, basically, that you need to compute the integral along the imaginary axis plus the integral around this pole with this circle here. And actually, if you do that, so you just write the amplitude in this way, you can compute very easily the amplitude. And you will see that the imaginary part only comes from this residue here. And what we get is exactly still the same type of Katowski rule that we also have in local case. And this is on the left-hand side. One can ask also the right-hand side what happened. Actually, the right-hand side is just sum over intermediate states. There is no contour prescription in that case on the right-hand side. It's very easy. We can show that the optical theorem still holds. Now, I'm running out of time, but the same can be done also for complex conjugate poles. The situation is more messy because we have extra pole in the propagators. We have a mess here. There are lots of poles. But the idea is the same. We need to start from Euclidean, we need to see where the pinching are, and we need to deform the contour in such a way that the pinching singularities are avoided. So if we do that, there are more funny contours. I mean, I'm not discussing them now because there is no time, but there are more funny contours, and the same can be done basically. In the end, for instance, for the simple line that I showed, one has to compute imaginary amplitude along, amplitude along the imaginary axis plus this contour. If one does that, again, what happens is these two contributions, which are complex conjugate, cancel each other and give, again, some imaginary part, which is what we would expect to be consistent with the optical theorem, which is still the standard Katowski rule, also here. The logic is the same as in the, real case. We'll not discuss this, I will just go towards the end. So, of course, here I just saw like some scalar field Lagrangian and I showed unitarity. But actually, one should ask, okay, can you generalize this proof in the case of gravity? And it's not, of course, straightforward because there are two more things to check. So in the case of gravity, one has like derivative vertices, and the pole structure is the same as in these models I showed because vertices do not introduce new poles. So the same type of prescription is more involved, but should apply also in that case. But since we have gravity, which is a gauge theory in the end, if we do it like we treat it as a quantum field theory, we need to also take care of unhealthy degrees of freedom, which are gauge degrees of freedom. So when we write down the completeness relation in the optical theorem like this, we need to make sure to remove basically the unphysical states as we usually do in gauge theories in local theory. Okay. Actually, I want to mention is that this proof can also be applied for type of Lagrange, like for instance, periodic string around perturbed around some vacuum. But let's go to some conclusions now. So here, I just basically give some proof of principle of like Lagrangian, which are still higher derivative, but can tackle somehow the problem of unitarity, which usually plugs higher derivative theories. What was important here is to basically go from finite higher derivative theories to infinite derivative theories. Okay. And we have managed to show some properties of this. And especially what is important is that unitarity can be really proven, although there are infinite order derivatives, there is exponential with the singularities at infinity and so on. Things can be done, computation can be made. Okay. Of course, not all expression can be evaluated analytically, but integrals can be written in such a way that you can evaluate them numerically. But there are of course many open problems. And for instance, so far I only showed Lagrangian formulations, but it's still not clear how to define really an Hamiltonian for these theories, because in principle you would have infinite convex, you will have infinite conjugate momenta into defined in Hamiltonian. But we know that the number of degrees of freedom is finite. So up to my understanding, there is still not a clear way to do to define Hamiltonian. And as a consequence, also comes out like how to define a good classical limit when we have, for instance, convex conjugate poles. Quantification of causality, violation of causality, which we already discussed something with John, but if there is still some violation of causality, one should really quantify that in a more precise way. And would be also very interesting to see what happens to singularity resolution in these theories, if really at nonlinear level, no locality can deal with the singularities and can smear them out and give some better behavior in the short distance and short timescale regime. But the main problem in my case, in my opinion, is that basically what I show so far are this construction with exponential of some gamma box, where this gamma box is an entire function, is very generic. So we cannot, there are really lots of possible choice for this gamma function. So it would be really nice to constrain this entire function here. Now there are several, for instance, I mentioned at the beginning, it's not safety gravity. Now here I just studied perturbative approaches, but one can imagine these non-local Lagrangian are non-perturbative. They appear as some effective action in isolated safety, who knows. In that case, it would be nice if isolated safety, for instance, can constrain some non-local form of the gravitational Lagrangian. Maybe it will not be something like this, but it would be nice to see what happens in that case. But again, there is a big problem of arbitrariety here because these functions here are very generic. So one can say, okay, phenomenological, we can constrain them. There has been some work, especially in inflationary cosmology, but even there, the choice are still very, very large. So one should really try to find some local principle, guiding principle to fix these four factors. It would be nice to think if it's possible really to do that. I know that in the your group, there is also some people working on like string theory, reciprocity, and so on. I think it's Laurent Fredel. I don't know if he's in the audience, but there is, for instance, what I found a couple of years ago, which was very interesting for me, I will just mention this. This paper by Born in the 49, even before these examples of string theory, where he wanted to formulate basically all theories invariant under this reciprocity transformation. And what we get, I still have to understand how we get that, but what he claims is that if you start from this principle, you would get, so if you start from this type of invariance, you would get some type of non-locality. You see, this type of operator here is really what I wrote before, exponential box. And he says that basically, if you assume a reciprocity theory, then this non-locality is a necessity. So it seems that what he's claiming is that non-locality is a necessity once you start from this reciprocity principle. And he also wrote several papers on this. For instance, he applied reciprocity theory in electrodynamics, and he got exactly this non-local operator here, exponential box, acting on the electromagnetic field and so on. So I don't know how he did that, but would be nice maybe to see if really there is some connection in terms of guiding principle. Of course, maybe this in the end will not be a physical way to proceed. It's not clear, but at least it was nice for me to find these papers to see that there is some, in the last sentence, there was some people working on trying to get this non-locality from first principles. And with this, I will just, close here. So thank you very much. And sorry for taking 8 minutes more, actually 4 minutes more.
thanks, Luca, for the great talk. Okay, so are there questions in particular first from students?
Questions, Colin?
I have a question.
John first, okay, students first, so Charlie.
Sure.
So I was wondering what leads to this pinching between these two poles? Sorry if there's a lot of noise, but I was wondering what leads to the pinching of these poles. You said when you're drawing all the contours and stuff, and you said Q3 will run into Q2. I was wondering what's making them run into each other instead of just running around.
Sure. Because what I'm saying is that you are, this is even in local, just let's take the local example, which is enough, is the same. Yeah. I mean, so what happens is that you have poles here. Okay, you have four poles in the complex plane. And two of these poles will depend on the external momentum, sorry, on the external energy, which is P0. Indeed, if you see the expression here. Okay, these are the four poles that appear. And just because, you see, you have this P0 here, which has an external energy. Okay. What I was saying before is that, for instance, if you start from the Euclidean axis, you will have initially like a real part which is equal to zero. But at some point, when you want to analytically continue from imaginary to real values, okay, what happens is that this P0 will start moving with a change values. Okay, so this pole here will move in the complex plane. And if you study the relation among these poles, you can see that there are cases in which two poles can hit each other. For this case, it doesn't happen that more poles can hit each other, only two poles can generate pinching in this small loop case. And for instance, for positive energies, this happens when these two hit each other. Because if you impose this equal to K2 equal to 3, you can really solve in terms of P0, and you can get a physical relation which tells you that when P0 is positive, this P0 will be equal to omega k plus omega k minus p. And when this happens, you have a pinching, which means that you hit the contour from two different sides. And they move just because, you see, you're starting, you're analytically continuing this P0 from imaginary value to any type of real value this energy will have, okay, which you don't know in principle. But this is not related to no local theory. You can make the same discussion also in the local case. Just for it's just basically what happens to poles in the complex plane. I hope it's clear. Ah, okay, good.
Okay, more questions from students.
I guess Benjamin is not a student.
No, just want to see if there is any other question from students before going to the senior / postdoc. But seems like there are none for now. So next, Benjamin.
Hello?
Benjamin, you can, we cannot hear you, I think.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, sorry about it. Hi, Luca. Thanks for this really nice talk. I was wondering, or like, I wanted to press a little bit on one of the problems that you mentioned, namely the arbitrariness in this in this function. So yes. Beyond asymptotic safety, do you have any idea of how to fix that? Or really, if you think about it, what do you really gain in introducing all this structure compared to just EFT, where we just also have to fix an infinite number of couplings, but we kind of have a very nice locus structure and we get all the things that you have to build in by hand for free. So what is really the advantage of this?
I totally agree with that. That's why I said this is a huge problem, the arbitrarity. Now, what you gain in principle for some function, for some choice of this gamma function, here in the function, people have shown that you can get like a renormalizable theory, and which are also unitary. But again, having many good theories is the same as having basically a theory with many couplings, which is not renormalizable. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
If you just say in this way. So in my opinion, it is still good in having effective field theories, but one has to try to understand whether these non-local theories really make sense. And to make sense, they need to be more unique. Because if you have many theories, you cannot really do. I agree with that. But if I wouldn't like to just stick to effective field theory, for sure. I would prefer to see what can be done beyond that. And okay. In this sense, I guess if there is no guiding principle, maybe there exists no guiding principle, nothing can happen in this sense in terms of fixing the form factors, then these no-local theories are no good. But I agree with you that we need some uniqueness to really go on. Otherwise, there is too much freedom. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as guiding principle, I showed these slides of these papers of Born from the 50s, 40s,
yeah.
Where he was starting from this reciprocity. Now, I still have to understand those papers, but that was the only, let's say, first principle derivation of some local operators that I found.
And maybe related to that, in the community, have people looked at like R cubed terms or higher? Because obviously, yeah. At first order interested in the flat propagator, but as soon as you look at the either the propagator in a curved background or at loop diagrams where you have vertices with at least three legs, these higher order terms play a role. So is anything known about that?
So you mean like just taking R cubed term and putting inside some no-local operators?
Exactly, yeah. You so would get a four factor with three arguments.
Yeah, So there is the group, what I know for sure is that in these no-local theories, there is the group by Modesto, Rockwell, and other people, where they introduce cubic terms, and even higher, but still local, high derivative, but local. These terms were needed to cancel some local divergences coming from in these no-local theories, and they were using this term to make the theory finite.
I see.
That's what they claim, at least they claim. But I never seen any type of cubic terms in which you have, for instance, something like this. I don't know, just to give an example. Something like this, for instance. And actually, with the Zravan, which is in the audience, we were trying to see how we can do the same, like for the quadratic Lagrangian, what we can say in the cubic case, if we can make some classification of the most generic F of box terms with R cube. Which is, by the way, very complicated. There are many, many terms, but I think it's still open.
But so maybe as a reference, there is the non-local heat kernel computation from, I think, 20 years ago.
Barbisky.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And they do have a classification, at least for non-local form factors, and then that would probably be helpful.
We found that, so they focus on the non-analytic terms. With this logarithm of box and one over box, basically, I think, right?
No, not only. I mean, they have a complete characterization of all the invariants that you can write down at cubic order.
Ah, okay. I thought there was only non-analytic. I thought, okay.
No, they also have a characterization of all them, and they compute the heat kernel up to that order, which is really... Okay. An amazing piece of work. I mean, it's 200 pages long. It's really.
I know there is 3-4 papers like this. I think some part, more parts. I think right. There is like.
Exactly. I think it's the last part of this series.
Okay. I thought papers. It was just a loop correction, like quantum correction, which are non-analytic, like a logarithm one over box. I thought it was something like that. But okay, I will check it.
Yeah, maybe we can discuss it later privately.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, next, John.
Yes, thank you for your nice and clear talk.
Thank you.
So the whole issue is from the beginning in quantum field theory, you have to choose a distribution function at the vertices.
Mm-hmm.
And the simplest one is a Dirac delta function. And that leads to a local theory. But it's full of divergences and infinities. And that's not nice. Who wants that? Okay. So the next simplest distribution is a Gaussian distribution, which, by the way, tends to a delta function when the width of the distribution goes to zero. And then so on. So there are, of course, many number of distributions you could choose. We've always known this. So if you stick to the simplest one, next to the Dirac delta function, which claim is positive, then you can establish, as you point out, a nonlinear theories, which are perturbative unitary, we can still argue about causality, but those causality violations, if they exist, will probably be small outside the light cone. Anyway.
I will be small, I agree with you.
In my one of my first papers 30 years ago, I did claim that causality was violated. I may have changed my mind since then. Anyway, so the issue of string theory and classical and string quantum string field theory are non-local theories. And we can do all of this with this theory here, including quantum gravity, in four dimensions. We don't have to go to 10 and 11 dimensions. So regarding gauge invariance, so 30 years ago, I established with collaborators that if you choose a non-local gauge transformation, as you do in string field theory, you can get fully gauge invariant non-local theories, which decouple all the unphysical modes. Mm-hmm. Regarding your issue of Liouville theorem, I think that FMOS regularization method, and I also published on this, is equivalent to your nice result in avoiding the balls by contour integration. I think they're equivalent, actually. You may want to look at those early papers, 50s and 60s.
Is the one
regarding
by,
one last, by, yeah, yes, sorry.
Is the Weber FMOS single author? Because I know there is one.
Yeah, he's a single author and other collaborators. So. Uh-huh. He published in Communication and Mathematical Physics. Okay. And, I have the references if you're interested. Okay. Finally, regarding this question of why are we doing this? Well, we want a fundamental quantum field theory which doesn't have divergences. Dirac claimed this for years from the beginning. He invented quantum field theory. He never liked the infinities, not at Feynman, by the way. So this is a way of getting around the divergences. And in the latest paper, my collaborator Martin Green, we established that these quantum field theories have no ghosts for simple distribution. And there's no Higgs hierarchy fine tuning. There are no fine tunings when you do SU2 cross U1 weak interactions for the standard model because there are no infinities. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the comment.
More questions? Okay, I would also ask a bunch of questions. Maybe I will limit to one or two. Yes, of course, we can continue later. So maybe I will just limit to one specific point of your talk that is about singularity resolution. So related to the fact that you would like to constrain the form factor, so the function gamma, do you think that at least, say, within this linearized approximation would be possible to put constraints on the form of gamma based on the requirement of singularity resolution?
You mean just a weak field limit, just taking linearized?
I think that this is what is feasible at the moment. It would be nice to have the full nonlinear result.
Yeah, indeed. I think that for sure at the nonlinear level, if really one find a way to find solution, there mm-hmm. we ask as a principle, we want the regular solution or any kind mm-hmm. of. In that case, I think we can constrain a lot, maybe this form factor, but there is no known solution at the nonlinear level, I think. Full nonlinear level. I mean, at least mm-hmm. full nonlinear level. But if you just ask, for instance, in weak field limit, you will have something like this, right? With some row here. Where this function f is just some entire function of Laplacian. And there is still an infinite class of function which gives you the same regular solution. You just change the coefficients, but you still get
Okay, whenever you have an entire function, essentially, whenever
not, I wouldn't say always for infinite cosine of Laplacian, which is entire. Mm-hmm. For sure, in this case, I mean something should fail. But if you take like a function with not zeros, sorry, we take function with like polynomials. You take some mm-hmm. polynomial mm-hmm. with the right sign of the Laplacian.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Then you get always a regular solution, for instance. I mean, there have been studied many, many different cases. So I think there are infinite choices you can make, which are still.
Mm-hmm. Okay, for now, at least within the linearized approximation.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I see. Yeah.
Yes.
And do you know of any work in progress to develop more powerful techniques to solve the equations not in the weak field limit?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean I never got any good result, but we have at least a solution which are beyond like a non-one like Schwarzschild and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take like a vacuum solution, like Schwarzschild will be vacuum solution also there, if you take mm-hmm. this Lagrangian, of course. This Lagrangian, since you have only rich fat solution will be a solution also in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now we with the author is Raman, also Alex Koshlev and so on, we were studying just the vacuum solution for this theory. Mm-hmm. And making some assumption a couple of years ago, we got like that, just making assumption like we're considering only this type of action. Okay. We're considering this type of action for vacuum solution, and what we were showing that the only solution basically was basically a rich flat, okay? But we were making mm-hmm. an assumption just that we can expand in Fourier
mm-hmm.
in some basis, which we don't know because we're in curved space. But we assume it exists on some Fourier basis to write this in this way, where these are like again values and so on. We were assuming this, like we usually do in Minkowski, without explicit form of this thing. If you do that, in the end, you get basically you have only a rich flat solution as a vacuum solution, nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
But we never try to, I mean, we are still not very happy about it because we are making this strong assumption, but mm-hmm. we are thinking to still work on it. We were discussing with Raman actually a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But no, so in my opinion, in my understanding so far, there is no, I don't know if John has some thought about nonlinear solution, but I don't know nonlinear solutions here.
Mm-hmm.
An example.
Okay. Great. So I think it's a good point to end the discussion since we are already here since 1 hour and a half, I believe. So thanks a lot, Luca, for accepting the invitation and giving this great talk. So I would ask everyone to thank Luca by clapping them.
Thank you very much.